Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Christina Dorr Drake, CEO and co-founder of Willa's, the only oat milk that uses whole organic oats, making it richer, creamier, more sustainable, and more nutrient dense than any other oat milk on the market. Inspired by her grandma Willa's homemade oat milk recipe, Christina launched Willa's in 2021 with her sister Elena and husband Russell. Willa's is now available in over 250 retail stores, including Erewhon, Foxtrot, and Central Market, and directly online or on Amazon. It's also served in several influential coffee shops around NYC. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me, Allie. I'm such a huge fan. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. And it's funny because I don't know, I haven't posted it yet. But I have a very special, don't say his name, 200th guest. And I recorded his episode a couple weeks ago. And he mentioned you when he was being interviewed. And then I had just met you the day before because we're doing this panel thing together. And I was like, this is like, you know, the force or whatever it is. Telling me that I need to meet this woman and interview her. And I've been like watching Willa's and kind of like, ooh, this looks like a good one from afar for a while. So anyway, I'm thrilled that you're here. Thanks for being here.
That's so cool to hear. I'm so curious who this guest is.
I'll tell you after. Yes. It's like 200 episodes is like a big deal. So I kind of need like a splash.
That's quite a milestone.
I know, it's crazy. It's funny because I was just talking about how, I've never gone back and listened to any of them because, you know, no one really, I think, likes the sound of their own voice. And I say, you know, a lot, and it bugs me. But I do know that at the very beginning, you know, here we go. I asked questions like, what are sales and what is marketing? Because I really didn't know. And I guess I still am trying to figure it out, but it's a little embarrassing. And so just to think about 200 episodes ago, not knowing what operations even was, is kind of, it's a sort of nice time capsule for me of actually building this business, even though it's a little embarrassing. So,
I mean, well, thank you for being down to put yourself in a vulnerable position and ask the questions that we all wonder about as well.
Yeah. And I think we'll get into you now because I think you are also a founder that is comfortable with vulnerability. And I think the world needs more of that right now. And I also sort of think that's a quality that's going to be much more appreciated than, let's say, it has been in the last several years. So kudos to you. Let's get back to before Willa's. I know that you were working in advertising for most of your career. We can talk about some of the lessons you learned from that later. But there was something in 2018 that you decided to do with this, you know, oat milk thing, and you quit your day job. And so I guess try to go back, if you can, to that decision and what was the plan? You know, what were you thinking and why?
Yeah, leaving your career when you're established, you're in a leadership role, you're really enjoying it, you're, you know, you're making a decent salary. I mean, yes. it wasn't an easy decision. Yep. but I had this feeling that it was a bigger risk not to give this idea a shot than to try it. And, you know, I gave myself 3 months to see how much traction I could get. I was also freelancing for the agency that I used to work at. But mostly working on Willa's and trying to figure it out, with Elena, and then pretty quickly Rusty came on board. And yeah, I just was looking for signals that we were onto something. And I figured it at 3 months, you know, we weren't seeing those signals. If it didn't seem like this idea had potential, I could, you know, go find another job. But we just kept seeing little signs that really felt like we were onto something. And, you know, back then, you know, now a lot of people are talking about health and ingredients in plant-based milks, but back then that wasn't really part of the conversation. And we were just really tired of plant-based milks that were mostly artificial ingredients and tons of sugar. The client that I had been working on was Panera, when they took out all the artificials and preservatives from their whole menu item, or from their whole menu. So all of their menu items, hundreds of ingredients were being slashed out, this whole education on food. And I was shocked to see that these so-called plant-based, healthy, you know, milks in my fridge had ingredients that were so harmful. Fast food restaurants were taking them out of their menu items. So yeah, my sister and I really just started with my grandmother's oat milk recipe that was really delicious using real ingredients, and got to work, and then just kept learning more and more things about the category that we wanted to change, and realized we needed to completely redesign the way that oat milk was made in the process.
I mean, I do want to talk about that, because I actually, you know, I was going to ask you about this later, but at, you know, at the cooking school, we were very early. I mean, I think in like 2014, 2015, we really tried to make our own oat milk. We were uncomfortable buying, you know, when I started in 2012, people were still drinking soy milk, and, you know, rice milk was kind of like exotic. but we really wanted to make oat milk. This was before Oatly hit the scene like gangbusters. And it's really hard. I mean, we had so much waste because we would, you know, squeeze it and basically get the milk, but we had so much extra oat waste. And from my understanding of what you're doing, you're not having all of that waste. And so how did you figure that out from a scaling perspective? I mean, you had to, Elena, you said your sister is some sort of scientist, I think. So, I mean, how long did that take? That must have taken a little while.
It took a little while. I mean, we had this idea in 2017. We got to work on it in the summer of 2018, and then kind of fully went for it in 2019. And we didn't launch fully until January 2021. That story you're telling is that's so interesting. Yeah, it's not easy to make plant-based milks in general, and making oat milk is definitely not straightforward.
We tried to bake it into cookies. You know, we tried to make a face scrub. Yeah, like we were going for it. We were, because, you know, the whole thing was about sustainability, and so we didn't want to have this thing with all of this byproduct that we were just tossing. But, you know, we couldn't figure out what to do with it. And we And so it is, it's funny because when you're talking about the whole oat, I'm like, I know exactly what she means by the whole oat, you know, like we have that problem. So tell me, like, Elena, yes, go back to Elena.
Yeah, no, she has a chemical engineering background, which basically means she's got a really strong engineering background, and her career has been spent trying to change the food system from the inside out, on the co-manufacturing side, optimizing co-manufacturing plants all over the world. And then she brought on Laura, who's a fellow engineer, and they're both brilliant. Creating an oat milk using the whole oat versus just highly processed oat sugar, which is what most oat milks are, which is why they have so much sugar and not a lot of benefits. Using the whole entire oat was not straightforward. We did a ton of research. It started with Elena and my mom taking my grandmother's recipe and doing hundreds of versions of it, nights and weekends, just in their kitchen, over and over, to use the whole oat, and also just to ensure that, you know, they were optimizing my grandma's recipe to make sure that it worked really beautifully in coffee as well.
Right.
And so there was that. And then, just frankly, fortitude and believing that there had to be a more honest and more sustainable way to go about it. And what's really inspiring about our team is everybody has this attitude that everything is figure outable. And, you know, I think in the early days, we kind of had to tell ourselves that sometimes, you know, when it's really tough in the early days and you're not getting that, like, that initial, like, you know, sales feedback because you haven't even launched yet. But we went through so much in our first few years that I think now we have more resilience than probably a lot of teams that have been around much longer, or businesses that are far more established, just because we went through so much and overcame so many challenges in the first few years and figured out things that no one else in the category seems to have even attempted.
Yeah, I'm a big believer. I think of it as, like, you know, you're swimming through mud and then all of a sudden the mud clears and it's water and you're like, oh, wait, what? Like, this is swimming? You know, I just kind of, I'm kind of waiting for the mud part to thin up a little bit. But I think that, you know, building something that's really hard strengthens a muscle in you that makes you very prepared for a lot. And I can't say that I always chose it to be hard. I just kind of did something hard, not knowing how hard it was. But I do think that the muscles that we've built, the attention to every single thing, because every single thing counts when things are really hard, will serve us, and obviously will also serve you well. But I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, because you were talking about signals, and I'm assuming that's because you did have this expertise in advertising and I guess a little bit of, you know, culture and where culture sort of intersects with business and people's needs and problems to be solved and all that. And so can you give me an example of, I mean, because you didn't have a product on the market for a few years, you were working on it. So what kind of signals were you seeing, and like what made the blinking start a little bit?
In those early days, those first few months where I was like, okay, Christina, you've got 3 months, let's see what you can do. Mm-hmm. And if this is worth it. And we submitted for kind of the top food and beverage accelerator program at the time. Mm-hmm. We did not have a brand name. We didn't have a product. We didn't have a formulation. We had like nothing done, but they were really excited about our idea. We didn't end up doing that accelerator, but that was one. Another one was, I was asking everyone I knew, who knows somebody who's an entrepreneur or started a food or beverage business. And, I talk to anybody who would talk to me. And a lot of those folks really encouraged us. Also, my cousin Teresa comes from a merchandising background as a buyer.
Wow, you guys, you're like the Partridge Family. This is amazing. You have advertising. Your sister's a scientist. The other one's a merchandiser. There's going to be someone who plays guitar.
My cousin,
and like another one with a tambourine, and you're like ready to rock and roll. I love this. And your husband,
Oh yeah, he's got his own set of skills.
Is he sales?
He sells, of course.
That tracks. This is amazing.
He's a Dale Carnegie master trainer. But I mean, growing up, you know, Elena's like, you know, enjoying Calc 5 or whatever, and I was like, "Who are you? Like, how are we related?" And now we're so grateful.
Of course, I mean, I can totally see the movie of like the two of you being little, and she's doing, you know, science, and you're doing surveys, and then you know, you meet your. It's perfect. I mean, so you have like many cousins all over the place that have all of these perfect skills for the, you know, for the startup that you're building.
We have one cousin, and she really, really believed in us in the early days. And so, she was another one of those signals.
And so tell me, going back to the, you know, I liked the way you were talking in an article, and you said, you know, strategy is sort of this intersection of business opportunity, target audience, and where culture is headed. And I guess my question to you is, you know, is that sort of the formula? Was that on your mind when you were thinking about getting ready to launch and building this, you know, those three things: business opportunity, target audience, where culture was headed, and how did that influence your go-to-market sort of plans?
It 100% was. I mean, that was my role and strategy. You know, it was making sure that we had a really clear understanding of the business objectives and developing the path to get there, and then serving as sort of a springboard and a sandbox for the creative team, and then making sure that that work hit their objectives while also working really closely with, you know, the CMO and marketing team and leadership team. So it was a wonderful training ground for entrepreneurship. I really love research, qualitative, quantitative, ethnographic. And so that, you know, has definitely informed the approach we've taken to everything. We did a ton of consumer research and blind taste tests in the early days. Right before the pandemic, I showed up at the WeWork headquarters because we had some connections there. And I did blind taste tests with our formulation versus Oatly with like 100 people. So we just did tons and tons of research. And then I think on the flip side, I knew what we were up against. I knew that we didn't have resources. We didn't have tons of money. We didn't have a big ad budget. And so I was looking for channels that had sort of built-in marketing. And I was really excited about offices and co-working spaces. And, you know, because you sell to them and you essentially get sales and sampling and brand awareness at the same time. It was a really great idea, except for the fact that we were planning to start it and launch it in 50 WeWorks in March of 2020.
So that might not have been right. That might not have come to fruition. But I do think that you bring something up that's really important that I'm talking about more and more with emerging brands. And it's this idea that there really isn't, it's not, you don't have to start at Whole Foods. There are so many people out there. As long as you are, like you said, as long as there is a target audience, and it should be, in my opinion, and you're the marketer by training, but I feel like the more that I know, the more targeted that target audience needs to be to really get off the ground the way that you want to. We all think target audience, Instagram. Target audience, 23 to 40 year olds who care about their health. Like, no, it's not a target audience. Like, who is this person? And it feels like there are so many more channels and so many more markets and so many more routes that brands can take if they just get a little creative about it. You know, medical offices, 100%. Old age homes, you know, I mean, they're camps, like they're places where people are sticky, and if they love you, they're going to tell all their friends about you. And you were onto something, right? I mean, you couldn't have predicted a pandemic or, you know, Adam Neumann being a maniac, but, you know, like you did have, you were going in a zig when everyone was zagging.
We were. I mean, you know, and I still believe in the food service channel wholeheartedly. You know, even if, for instance, if you're looking at that channel, you might say, oh, the gross margin isn't as strong because whether you're looking at, you know, restaurants or coffee shops or offices, maybe the margin, you know, isn't as strong, but you're not spending tons of money on something. You're not spending for trade spend. You're not spending for marketing. In fact, a lot of food service channels, they're asking you for signage and they're not charging you for it. They're asking you to make it with them and help them sell it. And so it can be really beneficial for getting volume and getting, you know, just, you know, everybody's getting pressure right now to have, you know, a path to profitability. Whole Foods might not be the pathway to profitability for every brand in their early days.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm back with Christina Dordrake, CEO and co-founder of Willa's. Okay, so you're getting ready to launch. A few things happen. You're getting ready to launch primarily in offices and in food service. You got hit with a couple of whammies here. There was a pandemic, and you also had a pretty scary and not good diagnosis. So tell me a little bit about that.
2020, it was a nightmare that I wouldn't wish on anyone. And it was also probably, you know, a catalyst for more growth and more gratitude than I have ever experienced in my life. Yeah. Very complicated emotions around it. But essentially, in January of 2020, as we were getting ready for this big launch in offices and co-working spaces and some coffee shops, I thankfully, my mom was always pushing me to do self-exams, and I wasn't as religious about it as I could have been. But thankfully, I did one in December, and I felt something that was just like, not what I remembered feeling before, but I wasn't really sure what I was even doing with the self-exam. And I think most women don't know how to do self-exams. I think all of us are just kind of like, what? But this is just a PSA. Look up some, there's really good videos. Ask your doctor, do your self-exams. And thankfully, I got in to get a mammogram, and I had early stage breast cancer at 36 years old with no risk factors or family history. I was completely blindsided by it.
This was December of 20.
I was diagnosed in January of 2020.
Wow.
In December 2019, I did my self-exam and felt something weird.
Right. Oh my gosh.
January 2020. And then I started chemo 2 weeks before the shutdown.
Wow.
I did chemo for 5.5 months, immunotherapy, then had lumpectomy, lymph node surgery, radiation. I worked more than full time through all of it on Willa's and feel really grateful that I was able to do so. I learned so many lessons through that time. And thankfully now I'm cancer free. And by the time they went in for surgery, there was almost nothing left, which means I had a really phenomenal complete response and it's unlikely to come back. So I feel a lot of gratitude now, but it was so hard.
I mean, I'm sorry doesn't even begin to cover it, but I am. And that must have been terrifying. And, you know, it was also just compounded by not, you know, doctor's offices not being open and transportation being harder. And the pandemic just made everything just
scarier. I couldn't really leave our apartment for anything other than doctor's appointments, because if I got COVID, I wouldn't be able to go to the cancer center for 3 weeks and I'd miss my chemo appointment. So we were so scared. In addition to obviously, you know, I got COVID really badly. So yeah, it was insane. My husband was working around his laptop from the car outside of the cancer center during my appointments, which I think was in many ways much worse than what I was going through. Wow. I think what was the biggest lesson I took from it was that, you know, when you're having all these treatments done to you, you feel really powerless. So I felt like I wanted to have an active role in my treatment. And there's a lot of research that suggests working out after chemo can help. And, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with eating more plant-based and doing meditation and stuff like that. It certainly didn't hurt. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to take time each day for the things I need to do just to help me get through this time. If I need to journal about all of the emotions I'm having right now and all the fear, if I need to do a workout every day over lunchtime, if I need to meditate to start my day, I'm going to do that because I need to figure out how I can get through this and launch this business in the midst of it all. And then I realized, why am I just giving myself permission to do these things because I'm going through cancer treatment, you know? So yeah, I guess, you know, I sort of went from being somebody who, when they're feeling anxious, kind of doubles down on work and says, oh, I don't have time for myself, and learning a lot about how important that is, especially as an entrepreneur, when you need to be there for yourself so you can be there for your team and for the brand and make good decisions in difficult moments.
I don't know, you know, it's so interesting, and I don't talk a ton about gender on the podcast because, you know, I just am a woman, I guess, but I do think that there is just this weird fundamental misunderstanding that is burned into our brains very early on as women that our self-care, for lack of a better word, is really secondary, and that it's selfish or it's lazy or it's self-indulgent. I mean, you know, luxurious. Everyone knows, like, I you know, a massage, I would be like, I'm not going to tell people that I got a massage. Like, that feels like really just, do I think I'm Kim Kardashian? Like, there's something so bizarre about, meanwhile, like, in many cultures around the world, that's just considered good old fashioned, move your lymph around and like get some blood flow to certain areas of your body. Like, it's
and
just
sit a little taller, like, you know, and not have
exactly like you know, what, you know,
but shoulders and injuries. And,
I mean,
I think equally with entrepreneurs.
Well, right. So that's a double compound, right? Exactly. So you take a woman who's already not, you know, not comfortable sort of taking care of herself because it's, you know, whatever you want to call it. And then you add, you know, this founder thing to it where all we do is sort of worship the hustle and the, you know, never, you know, just like I slept on the floor and I slept on the plant sore, and I slept standing up, or I didn't sleep at all. And, you know, it's a little ass backward. Right. And even still, I feel sort of, I talk about it. I can hear myself talking about it and hear myself, but there are times where I will be like, you took a vacation, or you want to take a Friday off? Huh? You know, it's like
feeling
burned in my brain. It's really unfortunate. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to like move on to the market, but you know, when you were in that period of, was it a year, 18 months, something along those lines in treatment and sort of post treatment?
When you're younger and you get hit with this diagnosis, they throw everything at you. So I was in what they call active treatment for basically from February through early fall. And then, I went into kind of the next phase, which is the one I'm in now, which is I'm on a drug that does like a little extra work to help keep my cancer from ever coming back, which is lucky right. that I have the kind of cancer that you can have a drug like that. It's a long haul. I mean, there's so many different phases to it all. And in some ways, the most difficult part is actually when you're done with the active treatments, because you go from people watching on you all the time and going to all these appointments and people check everything. And then all of a sudden you feel like you've just been like thrown out to pasture and nobody's looking out for you. So that it's a long road, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of times I tell my story and my friends will be like, oh my God, I have to get a mammogram. And it's like, no, get the mammogram just because you can get more information about your body. You know, you don't go to the dentist thinking you're going to have mouth cancer. You're doing it so they can tell you like, oh, there's something going on here or there. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing I would say is like, and there's so much that they can do. If God forbid you do have it and they catch it early. All that's to say, I feel super, super fortunate, but, it was a long haul.
Yeah. I mean,
and it took a while for my hair to grow back too. I was doing investor meetings over Zoom in a wig.
Yeah.
That my hairstylist like literally cut on her face, looking at me on a Zoom call being like, do you want it like this?
Right.
Cause I couldn't go to see her.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, I guess, you know, aside from the takeaway of, okay, this isn't indulgent for me to take care of myself because it's actually critical for my health, which is, you know, something that I think, I know a lot of founders that are physically and emotionally very run down, I guard that very ferociously. You know, I'm working really hard to relax a lot of the time, which I think might not make sense, but I mean that
makes sense to me.
Yeah. Actively working to like calm my nervous system down and slow my heart rate down and all of that stuff. But aside from sort of like deciding that this was not, something that was, you know, silly, that this was actually critical to your well-being, were there any other sort of takeaways in terms of the business and building the business and launching the business that you came away with?
One was, I was talking about resilience. I think in the early days of Willa's, I considered a good day as like, you know, having a really good day of sales or getting a major partner on board or something like that. And now I really try to celebrate the days where some challenge comes about, you know, every day there's like some new fire to put up and our team comes together and comes up with a really great solution and even turns that challenge into a new opportunity. And I think as an entrepreneur, the further you get down this path, or at least this is just the conversation I feel like I have a lot with folks who are much further along than we are, is that you eventually realize that every single day you're going to have really high highs and you're also going to have days where you get blindsided by challenges and you just have to except that you got through the last one. So why won't you get through this one? You know?
Yep.
The other thing it really validated for me was our commitment to using clean ingredients, to using organic ingredients. Conventional oats are really heavily sprayed with glyphosate, which is Roundup, and you know, a known carcinogen, which is something I want nothing to do with.
Is Roundup still, like, what the hell? They've been talking about Roundup since Silent Spring. Like, literally, I think Rachel Carson was talking about it. I mean, God knows when. But, like, what? They're still spraying that? Or just is that not in America? Or, like, what? In America?
Definitely in America. I don't know why we can't get past it.
I have a feeling I know why.
Fair enough. And same thing with BPA and BPS plastic, you know? Mm-hmm. Also proven carcinogen, super correlated to breast cancer. So that's something, you know, we take really, really seriously on the Willis team. We've had brands come to us saying, hey, can we buy your product in a bag in the box so we can, you know, make it easier if we want to use it in something else. And I have not found a bag in the box that isn't BPA free or isn't just, you know, plastic that is not recyclable. So if there's anyone out there looking to innovate around packaging, please do. But it just really validated our commitment to using clean ingredients and wholesome ingredients and ensuring that our decisions are guided by our values and everything we do has to live up to my grandmother's name.
Which is such a beautiful name too. I love the name Willa, by the way. So going back to, you know, I remember, I think you probably know, if you've listened to this, I've had Mike Messersmith on. He's a wonderful guy. And Haven's Kitchen was actually one of the first cafes in New York to have Oatly. And I remember when there was like, people were offering my baristas $50 for one of our Oatlys because they couldn't get it. And it was like the great oat milk run of like 2016 or something. There was like some sort of crazy situation, but you knew you were going up against, you know, everyone from Oatly to Califia to all of the different, you know, regional brands and the big brands that were coming out with their own oat milks. And I don't know a lot about the category, but I do know that, it's got some heavy hitters with some deep pockets. And going back to, you know, your salesman husband and, you know, you thinking about route to market, aside from the food service and the office plan, like, how did you think about taking them on? Like, were your goals to just, okay, it's big, and if we can just take a little bit of share, we're in good shape? Were you trying to think of maybe we're going to try to position ourselves really differently from them? You know, how were you just, you know, I ask this mostly because for us, we've never had that slide of like, here are the other brands that are doing what we're doing. And here's like a little checklist of what makes us different because we've never had anyone else doing what we're doing, which sounds fun, but it's actually quite challenging. So we didn't really have any
benchmark. Different set of problems, right? Different set of challenges.
Exactly. So I'm just curious, like what did that page in your deck look like to you? Or like, what was your sales plan looking like to you, knowing sort of the way that the market looked?
We have never tried to be an Oatly copycat. And, you know, we always said that our values guide everything that we do. And as a result, you know, using the whole oat, using wholesome ingredients, we just have a completely different taste profile, nutritional profile, story, packaging. You know, while there seems to be a lot of conversation about similarities between a lot of different plant-based milks or common themes, Willa's is really kind of in a category of its own. And I think that was huge for us. At the same time, we didn't know that the consumer was going to follow the same path that we were headed. I remember having a conversation with a friend in 2019, and she said, well, I'm vegan, and I actually don't really care what ingredients are in the food I eat, as long as it doesn't have any animal, doesn't have any connections to an animal. And I was like terrified when I heard that, because I thought, oh my gosh, if this whole, you know, belief in going more plant-based just heads in the direction of, you know, say the Impossible Burger, Willis isn't particularly relevant. And I wasn't really interested in creating a brand that just kind of put its values aside and stopped caring about health of, you know, people on the planet. So, you know, in many ways we were making a bet on the consumer kind of following along in the direction we were headed. In terms of sales and piece of the pie, you know, as a small brand who wasn't intending to raise a ton of money early on, we knew that we were going for a small piece of the pie. But everywhere, every new channel that we go in, every retailer we go in, we always want to win. And we've even said no to a few big deals where it just didn't make sense from a margin standpoint, or the amount of support it would require would be so detrimental to our bottom line that it just couldn't possibly make sense. So we've just always focused on doing what is right for Willa's, focusing on using the whole of every ingredient we can, and creating a really strong platform and foundation for the brand that can thrive in good times and in bad times and really live up to its promise.
There are two things that you said that I want to pull on the strings of a little bit. One is sort of this return to what the natural and organic and better for you food movement used to be. And, you know, I wasn't at Expo West in 1995 or whatever, when people talk about, you know, I've been going to Expo West for 120 years and it was 8 kimchi brands and a kombucha that someone made in their, you know, their garage. So, but you know, when I first went to Expo West a couple of years ago, this was, I guess, 2019. I was really confused. I was like, wait, this is the natural and organic, better for you, natural foods industry. Like, what, some of these products, there's nothing natural about them. Like, this is not what I learned was, you know, better for you. And I think that there was this like, because, and tell me if maybe it seemed to me like the amount of money that kind of came into the industry so quickly and financed these, you know, quote unquote food tech businesses that were making alternatives that just had ingredient panels that were like bizarre with ingredients that, you know, are bizarre. And, you know, all the different types of sugar that now everyone's starting to be like, well, maybe cane sugar actually isn't the worst of all of them. You know, I mean,
maybe there's a reason why it's been around so long.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. Do you feel like maybe part of what's happening, because maybe the money is kind of slowing down and the, you know, the like rocket ships and we're a tech company, not a food company kind of banter is slowing down. Maybe there is this like return back a little bit to this core group of people who really want to eat better for you things that are also better for the environment, and potentially going back to some of those investors who were there in the first place. Like, has that been an experience for you?
Yeah, I hadn't even considered that it might have so much to do with venture and food tech. That makes a lot of sense to me. I think that's a really interesting insight. I think additionally, consumers didn't have a lot of options for a while, and now they have more options. For example, in the plant-based milk category, it used to be that you were lucky if there was even any option at all, especially at a coffee shop or an office place. And I think now we've gone from, you know, feeling like, oh, you should just be lucky that there, you know, that there's something plant-based and there's an alternative for you that might be a little bit less bad in some way, shape, or form, or not. And whether or not it's actually made of plants, let's just not talk about that. And now it seems like consumers, you know, they're just taking a much closer look and they're asking, you know, does this actually give me the benefits that it's supposed to? If eating more plant-based is supposed to have all these health benefits and nutritional benefits, shouldn't I be able to see those on the ingredients and the packaging? And I think, Yeah, maybe it's just happening on all sides right now, which, I mean, makes me really excited for all of the founders that are finding ways to use real, honest, plant-based ingredients and make delicious food with them.
And it does take a little longer to scale it. And it takes a little longer to build it because it's not necessarily as splashy. It's going to be more premium. It's going to be, you know, a smaller group at first, because it always is with, you know, sort of these innovative, really like when things are actually made to be better for you, you know, whether it's yogurt or, you know, cheese or whatever it is. The other piece that I thought was interesting is, you know, there is a lot of talk these days about, you know, everyone who's listened to this podcast knows that, like, everyone who's ever said anything is like, core then more, build it slowly, don't go too quickly, don't, you know how to say no, you know, all of that. But it's really hard. And it's also,
absolutely,
I don't think that a lot of emerging brands, and this is just a hunch, maybe this is just because I didn't, the margin on, because you said something really interesting, like there's the margin, but then there's the, what's it going to take to keep us going there? So even if you figure out, you know, I have to give this customer, you know, an EDLP or whatever it is. Okay. So now I know the margin. It's not exactly what I want it to be, but it's fine. Usually with accounts like that, that's just the beginning of where you're spending. And then you have your distributor OIs, but then you also have, you know, programs that you need to do with that retailer. And then inevitably, if it's not a great fit, at least on, I mean, maybe not for you, but for us, we spoil out if we don't sell out. And then we're paying for that. So I think, you know, everyone, just as you're listening, you know, I've said this kind of before, but this whole sort of like, it really is a time to look at every account, and some of them are going to be big top line numbers. But when you look at what you actually end up taking home and spending, you might be losing money on that account. So is there a way that you look at that going in? You know, it sounds like you're kind of eyes wide open and that you have said no. Like how would you advise someone to do that, to just make that analysis?
It's hard work, in all transparency. The weekend before this past weekend, Elena and I, while Rusty worked on a separate project, we spent an entire weekend running the numbers on all of our distributors, as well as some of the future, you know, plans that we have, and looking at it both from a gross margin and contribution margin perspective, as well as what does it mean if we hire a merchandising team? What does it mean if we have to, you know, all this additional marketing that we think they're going to ask for, or we heard from, you know, another founder friend that's going to be, you know, a requirement. What does it mean if, you know, say it's a university and they're like, yeah, we want to do this deal with you, but we want you to come over every week and do sampling, you know, like, so just like figuring out what is, because it's pretty astounding how you might think a certain channel looks amazing, and then you look at the end of the day and you're like, oh no, actually the bigger that channel gets, the more we're hemorrhaging cash. And I wouldn't say that, like, you know, it's super fun to spend your Saturday and Sunday running these numbers, but I do believe that when you do it, you learn so much about your business and you just feel so much more confident and clear-headed about what your plan is and what makes sense for you. And because everybody's got advice, but the numbers also kind of speak for themselves.
No, I agree. And I think it's, we all, you know, most of the founders that I'm talking to right now are just, you know, even the ones, you know, some of us we're having our best sales months ever, right? Or we're opening new doors or whatever it is, but everyone's worried about cash, except for the people who fundraised last year, basically. And, you know, you can have your best sales year ever and run out of cash. I mean, that it sounds almost counterintuitive, but it's a very real reality for,
especially, you know, in CPG.
I mean, primarily in this business. And, yeah, and that's why it always goes back to, you know, if you're starting, and I go back, I feel like Marsha, but it's like margin, right? The higher that you start, the kind of safer you are with all of these things nipping at it. And, you know, honestly, my old financial folks never spoke about contribution margin, ever. It was always about, you know, product margin and gross margin. I never even knew what contribution margin was until, you know, we brought in Amplify. This is our, like, our CFO that we're working with now. And because we've always had a really strong product margin and always had a really good gross margin. So I was like, wow, we're great. You know, and he's like, well, then there's this, you know, this other thing that gets, you know, kind of subtracted in there. So, you know, this is just like, we need to be literate about these things. And my eyes start to glaze over when we're talking about Excel and contracts and stuff like that. But if your eyes glaze over, then bring someone onto your team, or like, make sure that you have people that will sit with you for 8 hours on a Saturday and just figure it out and then leave. I mean, the great news is the channels that work. And I really, this is true, I feel like, in life and in business, when there is alignment, it's easy. You know, there's when you don't have to force the puzzle piece into the puzzle and be like, it's fine. There's a straight edge here. Like, I'm sure this is just fine. Like, you know, because we all want to do that, you know, but
we've
then you're like pushing
we've all
it
been in
and,
that mode before. Yeah.
And then when you try to pull the puzzle piece out, it kind of like sticks and it gets like, it's like annoying. And then you rip the paper a little bit and you're like, ah, shoot, you know, kind of mess that up.
Or you go to when sleep goes, at night and you're like, right, afraid that XYZ might not work exactly perfectly to plan. And now you're just stressed about all of the reasons why that puzzle piece might not stay jammed in there perfectly.
Right. I mean, and it's like, if it's meant to fit in there, it's going to glide in. And, you know, that might mean that, you know, I think one thing that I'm learning pretty quickly is my fresh sauce in a pouch doesn't glide in to every single grocery store in America's produce set. It just doesn't. And I've got to be okay with that, either readjusting the expectations on it or innovating where it does, but trying to fit my pouch, let's say, into Walmart would be a big mistake, just knowing what I know. And it has really nothing to do with, you know, exactly the cost of making it. It has to do with everything else on top of that. You know, what this pouch will do in that channel. And I think the more that we can kind of sit down with ourselves and hopefully with investors who understand, if you have them in there, and with people who get it, and you can figure out what's flowing, you know, fish where the fish are, this is a channel that's working for us. We're up whatever percent at this market. Let's really lean in and make it up even more. Have we even capped out on our velocity? Like, if we're selling 8 pouches a week here, could we sell 12? Could we sell 16? You know, and I think that's the strategy work that we're all kind of scared to do, but we need to do.
And it can be such an opportunity for creativity. You know, I think that's what I sometimes will get into a mode of like, oh, well, clearly this isn't going to work. And oh, so frustrating. And then, you know, thankfully, I feel like my co-founders and I like take turns having like high anxiety moments, and someone else will be like, well, wait, well, what if we rethought the packaging this way? Or what if we rethought
it doesn't this have piece to of the be formulation? So binary. Or,
yeah, exactly. And then sometimes it's like, you just need somebody else to kind of pull your head out of the weeds and be like, wait, but remember, like, creativity is why we're doing this, because we want to create new things. So like, let's embrace the constraints we have and see if we can come up with some cool new way to go about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think something you said earlier on about, you know, every day, you know, I don't know, my nervous system is definitely a little shot, I gotta say. I mean, you know, And we, I think as founders, we're a little addicted. Yeah. I mean, we're doing this because, you know, I always say, like, for someone who actually likes quiet and like calm, I have chosen a very strange route. Because, you know, yeah, it's really fun. You get these dopamine hits of like, oh my gosh, someone just reached out, or look at this, or, you know, this buyer just followed me on LinkedIn or whatever the hell it is, you know? And then you get this, yep, like, we're sorry, but it's just, you know, not going to work, or we're not even resetting until 2025,
yes,
or,
yes, you know, we're pushing our review out another year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pushing our review, you know, out another year.
Or, yeah, you know, I mean, there, I think I might've said this yesterday, like, there's a Makrut lime leaf shortage because of the California rains. Like, I don't even know what to say about that. You know, there was, right, a mirin shortage last year. I feel like
we had the worst oat crop since 1866 a year ago because of climate change.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, since 1866. I mean,
yes, yeah, which is really just how far back the records go.
That's exactly right. That's the first year they were like, oat crop. Okay.
Right.
So, but, you know, I think your method of trying to, you know, I also get very much like, all right, well, then I might as well just sell the whole farm and move to a yurt, and, you know, I don't need this.
This product is dead in the water, and everything, right, you know, is the worst.
And yeah, I've led all these people down to a river that's dry, and, you know, I should just go, you know, I don't know.
I feel like my anxiety, like, it can either be so helpful because in this business there's so many things that can go wrong,
right?
But at the same time, it's very easy to get into that spot that you're describing where you're like, oh, well, this is just a sign that, you know, there's another blow coming, you know what, yeah, I mean? Like,
yeah, of course. And I think also it's kind of like the flip side of our dedication and passion and choosing to build something that did not exist before is that we feel like if we don't make it happen, if we don't push this puzzle piece into the puzzle, it will never be a puzzle. And letting it just kind of, you know, flow a little more, you know, is part of the lesson, I think. You know,
yeah, and knowing that there's so much out of your control, and you might just have to, like, yeah, figure out where the flow is going, you, yeah, know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think building a good flow, I don't know. I always try to, like, think of the name as I'm, as we're talking, but I have a few ideas. Okay. Before we go, because I know Liam has to go and do another recording. Last question. Just tell me how you made that chocolate milk so absolutely friggin' delicious, because it is amazing. Like, what, did you just blend chocolate bars with, like, your delicious creamy oat milk, and it just tastes like?
Oh, I wish it was. Heaven. I wish it were that easy. That was actually, right, one that was not easy to get right. My mom does a lot of the formulating with my sister. My mom is sort of the keeper of Willa's recipes and the creator of many of them. And then my sister scales them up, and she had to do so many versions of it because we wanted to use this beautiful single origin Peruvian cacao. And we wanted to preserve the quality of the taste of the chocolate, but we also needed to balance the bitterness with the sweetness of the maple sugar.
Right.
Well, not turning it into a sugar bomb, because I was like, well, yeah, what's the point if it's, you know, 20 grams of sugar, we want to be at least half of that. And right. So, it was, yeah, we did so much consumer testing of different versions of it with kids. And so it feels amazing. So good to hear that you say you love it.
Yeah. Everyone needs to go to where you want people to go, willas.com.
You go to willaskitchen.com.
And get the chocolate
milk. Feel free to use, you know, Willa's Friends or Amazon. Yeah. Yeah, that product is up for a Good Food Award. We're so excited.
Oh, it's so good. Christina, thank you so much. I could have talked to you for hours, but I really appreciate you coming on the show. And I'm so glad that you're healthy. And I just send all of my good whole oat vibes to you. Just Stay healthy. Thank you so well. Much, you're building you. Something really beautiful. And Liam, thank you so much. Sorry about my timing. And I always appreciate you and your expert engineering. And listeners, I'm going to make it quick. I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.